Now, Moses has been focusing most recently here in the book of Genesis on this individual named Abraham. And in particular, we have seen God establish a covenant with him. Remember where he came from? He come from Israel? Now, there ain't no Israel yet, is there? There'll be one later, but we don't have one yet. Came from Ur, which is in Mesopotamia, the area where the Chaldeans live. That's why he's called Ur of the Chaldeans. And it was over there in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. Let me get my little red dot out here. You can see that from where you are, I'm sure. But he came from over here and then went up north to an area called Haran up here and then down to the land of Canaan. So that's kind of the route that we've seen him travel before. And it was when he got down there that God appeared to him a number of times, actually, and entered into this covenant with him known as the Abrahamic Covenant. And we've been seeing some aspects of his life now for the last few chapters. So where we want to continue on here this morning in chapter 16, he's still the focus of attention, Abraham is. And what we see here in Genesis 16:1 says, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar." Now, in tracing Abraham's movement earlier, what we see on this map, of course, is that he hadn't been to Egypt before until he went down there in chapter 12. See his route? Up north to Haran and down into the land of Canaan right here. Then in chapter 12, he decided that he was going to go down to Egypt. And you remember that story. As he got down there, he realized, whoa, my wife is a beautiful woman. These pagan heathens down here, they'll kill me to take her. So let's just kind of twist one on them and tell them that you're my sister. And what happened? She got scarfed up into Pharaoh's harem. That ain't a good place to be if you're a married woman. And you remember what happened there? God put the whammy on Pharaoh and his household, and they realized that something was wrong with Sarah being in that harem. I suspect that that judgment he put on them was some sort of a sexual disease, I suspect, something like VD, something like that. And the household realized, wait a minute. This is too much consistent with a problem of this nature. And the Pharaoh figured it out that Sarah shouldn't be in his harem. And he then rebuked Abraham, God's man, for lying to him and deceiving him about Sarah. And we talked about the fact that that's never good when the godless people in this world justly rebuke you. You may be rebuking them, but they shouldn't be rebuking us, God's children. But nevertheless, what happened there? All kinds of good stuff came his way, didn't it? Pharaoh treated him very well. Verse 16 of chapter 12 says, "Therefore he treated Abraham well for her sake, and gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants." And female donkeys and camels. He gave him a big fat bank account. So when he left Egypt, Abraham was rolling in it even more than when he went down there. And so we asked ourselves after seeing that incident, was that the right thing for him to do? After all, he came out of it with his pockets full of money. God's blessing on his life. Surely going down there was the right thing to do then, huh? It must have been. The end must have justified the means there. The end result was good. Lying to get to that end, that must have been okay. Uh-oh. We got the class mascot moving around here this morning. I think that's a wasp. He better not get near me if he knows what's good for him. Probably building a nest up there. So we asked ourselves, did he do the right thing? He must have. And we see there in verse 16 that among the other things Pharaoh gave him were servants, male and female servants. One of them, I think, was probably named Hagar. Where else would Abraham have picked up an Egyptian maid other than Egypt? And when was he in Egypt? In chapter 12, when he wasn't supposed to be. He's down there lying through his teeth and nevertheless getting blessed by God. So I suspect that this maid mentioned here in verse 1 of chapter 16, the Egyptian maid named Hagar, I suspect he got when he was down there. Well, hey, ain't he bad to be picking up servants and all that kind of stuff? Well, let's see how this storyline works out. So Sarah says to Abraham, verse 2 of chapter 16, "Behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children." She recognized who controls the fruit of the womb, didn't she? And God does that. God controls life. You can do all kinds of things physically, but God controls whether there's conception or not. And she recognized that. But here's her idea. She's put two and two together and came up with three and said, "Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children through her." Now, in this culture at this time, the children of concubines belong to the father, not the mother. So what she's saying to Abraham is, look, you go into my maid, have a child via her, that child will be ours, Abraham's and Sarah's, and that would then fulfill the promise that God had made to them to give them a line of descent. So you see her plot? You see her plan? It's sensible. It's not necessarily spiritual, but it's sensible for them to do. And I suspect she really had to twist Abraham's arm real hard to get him to buy into this plan. But he buys into it in verse 2 and says he listened to the voice of Sarah. Remember any other circumstance that we've looked at in this book where somebody was listening to the voice of someone that maybe they shouldn't have been? Eve listened to the voice of Satan. Adam listened to the voice of Eve, and nobody listened to the voice of God. Same thing's happening here, isn't it? Abraham is listening to Sarah and to her idea, but he hasn't listened to anything God has said or told him or consulted him or anything else. He said, sounds like a plan. Sarah, we'll do that. So they basically are taking a viewpoint that God ain't getting the job done, and so they need to help him out here. They need to come up with this human plan to provide this line of descent that God has talked about before, this great nation of people that's going to come through him. So God ain't getting the job done, and so they're going to do it for him. They're going to help him out. God helps those that help themselves, right? You ever heard that nonsense? God doesn't help those who help themselves. God helps the helpless. It's when you were dead in trespasses and sins that God made you alive together with Christ. You were helpless when God gave you a new life, a new birth. So God doesn't help them that help themselves. God doesn't need our help. So putting together a plan to help him out probably is one that is doomed before it ever starts. So after Abraham had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abraham's wife Sarah took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife. So any child produced there would be their child, legally. How many polygamous marriages do you know that are happy ones? You can count them on one finger, can't you? There aren't going to be very many of those. So he goes into Hagar, verse 4. She conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. Now, motherhood was extremely highly valued in this culture, and the lack of children was considered almost a curse. Well, women that had no children, they were not happy campers. So now all of a sudden, the maid, Hagar, she's with child, and her mistress, Sarah, isn't. And so Hagar despised Sarah. And Sarah says to Abraham in verse 5, she dumps on him, says, may the wrong done me be upon you. Well, whose idea was this, Sarah? Come on. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me. Sarah is unhappy, and she takes her unhappiness out on Abraham. Well, remember, the plan was hers in the first place. He could have rejected the plan, but he didn't. And so now there is great disharmony in the old household here. Sarah and Hagar are like this. And so Sarah explains her disharmony to Abraham, and Abraham doesn't do squat. Verse 6, instead of Abraham saying, all right, guys, let's all sit down and talk this through and work out some things and talk about some relationships and some boundaries and some things that we can do to get along together and live in some form of harmony. Instead of doing that, he tells Sarah, well, she's your maid, do whatever you want to. Behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight. Well, what do you think is going to happen? The scorned is going to somehow or another be very kind to the scorner? Of course she's not. So she treated, that is, Sarah, treated Hagar harshly. And she fled from her presence. Now, the situation isn't good, but Abraham could have done a little bit to maybe ameliorate some of the angst going on there. He could have made some decisions and led the family like he should have, and maybe something could have been done that's a little better than what happened here. So Hagar takes off. She says, I'm out of here. I cannot stand any more of this. And the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness by the spring on the way to Shur. Now here's another map that shows us where Shur is. Here's Shur right here. This is the desert of Shur right here. See that? She was up here in Hebron. So she's come down to about here. That's about 100 miles. She's made about 100 miles on her own. Single woman by herself out in the wilderness. She's doing pretty good, actually. She's on her way back to Egypt, where she came from. So she's traveling like this. And she gets about halfway down there, and the angel of the Lord finds her. Now, that's probably the pre-incarnate Christ. It could be somebody else, but I think it probably is him. And he speaks to her in verse 8 and says, Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? Now, when the Lord asks questions, it's never to gain information like we do. We ask questions because we don't know things, and so we want to know some more things, so we ask. He knows, but he's focusing attention on a certain subject when he does that. So here he asks her where she's coming from and where she's going. She answers the first half. She says, I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarah, or Sarai. Then the angel of the Lord said to her, well, return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority. So his instruction, and she recognizes this is a divine visitor, so she's paying attention, she's listening. He says, go back. Go back to where you were. And moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they too shall be too many to count. Now, he's already promised Abraham that Abraham's descendants would be too many to count. Kind of figure of speech, meaning a lot of them. Now he tells Hagar the same thing. Her descendants are also going to be extremely numerous. So that both lines of descent are going to prosper by the divine intervention of God. And the angel of the Lord said to her further, behold, you are with child. Now that, if she's not already convinced this is a divine presence, she probably is now. How would he know that? She's probably not showing anything yet. Doesn't look like it. Looks like it's pretty soon after conception, so she's probably not showing. So he knows she's pregnant. She now probably knows that this is indeed a divine visitor. And you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael. Ishmael means God hears. She thinks that God has heard her cry, her lament, and has come to visit her because of that. And so she's going to have this son named Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. And he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. He will live to the east of his brothers. Now, this guy is going to have a certain characterization associated with him. He will be difficult to get along with, difficult to live with. He's like a wild donkey, very difficult to manage, very difficult to control. And he will live to the east of all of his other brothers, Abraham's other sons. And that history can certainly be sort of verified by just looking at a map and thinking how things have gone for the last four millennia. And she called the name of the Lord who spoke with her, "Thou art a God who sees," for she said, I have remained here alive after seeing him. Therefore the well was called Beer Lahai Roy, because it is between Kanish and Bered, means the well of the living one who sees me. So she named this well after her experience of seeing God. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael. And he was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. Now we ask ourselves the question before, well, back when he was down in Egypt and probably was given Hagar by Pharaoh, was that the right thing to do? It looked like he came out of there cleaning up. Donkeys, camels, all kinds of cool rides, servants, money. I mean, good grief. That looked good, didn't it? And the result of that experience was Ishmael. Was that a good thing? What's been the history between Ishmael and Isaac and their descendants for the last 4,000 years? Animosity, hatred, killing. They're still fighting each other to this day. Now, one could argue, and I think reasonably so, that that trip down to Egypt back in chapter 12 was the biggest mistake Abraham ever made in his life. And the history of that mistake lingers on to this very day, and will until the Lord comes back in Revelation chapter 19. So, all's well that ends well? No. There's never an excuse for disobedience. And we see the lingering results of this. You think there's any satanic fingerprints on this particular incident? Remember what God promised Abraham. One of the three main features of the Abrahamic covenant is the three are land, seed, and blessing. The seed. The seed would be descendants of Abraham. It's going to be through Isaac. And from them will come God's chosen people. One of those chosen people will be the Savior of mankind, the Messiah, the Son of God, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world. If you can prevent that from happening, could you not mess up God's plan and program? Could you not mess up His plan of redemption for mankind if you can somehow or another contaminate and corrupt that line of descent? I suspect there's a bunch of satanic involvement here in trying to, in essence, supplant Isaac with Ishmael. So I think there's satanic fingerprints all over this incident, and the history of the two would seem to kind of bear that out as we come on down through time anyway. Satan has tried to prevent the Messiah from coming onto this earth in a variety of ways. And even when he got here, he tried to kill him. Remember Herod killed all them kids 2 years and under? He tried to kill him as many times as he possibly could. He just couldn't get it done, of course. So I think there was probably some involvement there as well. But chapter 16, our main takeaway here, is the birth of Ishmael and the history that follows that. You've got a chart in your handout. I'll just mention it now. It looks like this. It's a summary of Abraham's descendants. Notice over there on the left that there is a line of descent that comes down here through Sarah and then Isaac. And then from Isaac you get Jacob, and oh, you can see all of it here. And you get the 12 sons down here to the bottom.
What's the number? Page number?
Page 38 in your handout. Okay? But here's Isaac, here's Ishmael, and he's going to have 12 sons also. Here they are right there. They're actually named later in Genesis 25. But he is not in the line of the Abrahamic covenant. That comes down over here to these wives of Jacob and then his 12 sons right across here. See all those guys? That's the 12 tribes of Israel that come from Jacob and his four wives. So Ishmael is outside the Abrahamic covenant. None of the provisions in the Abrahamic covenant apply to the Arabs. None of them. They get some blessings from God. God blesses them because of Abraham. He does give Ishmael 12 sons, but they have nothing to do with the Abrahamic covenant. None whatsoever. So, this incident here in chapter 16 sort of sets up that line of descent there, that trail. Okay. Any question about 16 before we move on to 17? Okay. Chapter 17, we get the institution of the symbol, the sign of belief in that Abrahamic covenant. Let's see what that's about. Now, when Abraham was 99 years old, he lived to be 175 now, so remember, he's about halfway through his life, so maybe he's more like a 45-ish, 40, 45, something like that would be today, maybe. He's 99. The Lord appeared to him. This is the fifth time now that the Lord has appeared to him. I could walk you through all those, but you probably don't care. Fifth time he has appeared to him. And he said, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. It's a repeat of what he has told him before. Abraham fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abraham, which means exalted father, Abram. No longer shall it be called Abram. That was his name up to here. Exalted father, but it shall be called Abraham, which means father of many nations. So he's kind of altered it a little bit to stress the fact that Abraham is going to father these many nations. He goes from exalted father to father of many nations. And I'll make you exceedingly fruitful. I will make nations of you, and the king shall come forth from you. And I'll establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. So he's reminding him, restating, reiterating the promises of the Abrahamic covenant. And I'll give to you and your descendants after you land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession. I will be their God. So land, seed, and blessing, the same three covenant provisions that he mentioned before, he mentions again. And God said in verse 9, said further to Abraham, now as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. Now there is a sign that God associates with the Abrahamic covenant. Whoa, almost said Mosaic covenant. A sign is going to be given between God and Abraham to express and to indicate belief in that covenant, the Abrahamic covenant. What is the sign? It's circumcision. Now, Abraham probably, when he heard that, probably thought, well, can't we use like maybe a tattoo? Do we have to do it this way? Something's not quite so difficult. You shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. Every male among you who is 8 days old shall be circumcised throughout your generations. What's with 8 days? There's a vitamin in your blood that causes it to coagulate, and it is at a maximum on the 8th day of life. Any nurses in here? Vitamin K. They don't know that. They don't know about coagulating blood, or vitamin K, or vitamin A, B, C, D, E, F, or G. They just know that God said on the 8th day of life, circumcise your male children if you agree and believe in the Abrahamic covenant. And that's all they have to do is obey. They don't need to know the medicine behind this. But there is some. We know it now, but they didn't. But that's why he picked the 8th day. It peaks on the 8th day, and then it declines after that, and it's never that high again. So your blood coagulates the best it will ever coagulate on your 8th day of life. You ladies probably don't care. But that's a good deal for us guys. Every male among you shall be circumcised. It is a mark in the flesh of Abraham. It is an irreversible mark. You can't undo that. You can't go down to the tattoo shop and get that sucker erased. It is erasable. And that's going to be the mark that indicates belief in that covenant. Here's a little mind bender for you. What was the mark in Sarah's flesh to indicate belief in the Abrahamic covenant? Wasn't one, was there? No, the mark was totally in Abraham, in the males. Why is that? Why didn't she get a mark somehow to indicate her belief in the Abrahamic covenant?
Because it was given to Abraham?
Well, it was, but it's the Jewish parents all had to participate in this. This is an act that the parents would indicate their belief through their children, having the male children circumcised. What's the relationship between Abraham's flesh and Sarah's flesh? There's one flesh. Genesis chapter 2. For this purpose, a man will leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. You don't need two marks when you only have one flesh. And that's all they have. Abraham and Sarah is one flesh, and so one mark suffices for the two of them because they are one flesh. Okay? Now that concept has both a physical aspect to it and an emotional aspect to it, and you can destroy either one of those through misbehaving. You can destroy the one flesh physical concept, or you can destroy the one flesh emotional concept, either one. But that's why we don't need two marks here. We just need the one. The one serves both of them because in God's viewpoint, they are only one. So one mark, one permanent mark in Abraham's flesh is a sign of belief in the Abrahamic covenant. Almost said Mosaic covenant earlier. What's the sign of belief in the Mosaic covenant? Keeping the Sabbath. Okay? If you believed in the Mosaic covenant, you would keep the Sabbath. If you believed in the Abrahamic covenant, you would have your male children circumcised. Now, unfortunately, not everybody involved here is a child. All your people, a servant who is born in a house or who is bought with money from a foreigner who is not of your descendants, a servant who is born in your house or is bought with money, you shall be circumcised. Thus shall my covenant be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And a male who is uncircumcised, who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. So you either had your children circumcised, or in this case, there's some catch-up that has to be done. Abraham and all of his household also has to be circumcised. These are grown men. And that great whining and crying that they heard throughout the land wasn't just the children. The guys living by them, the neighbors living around them, probably heard a commotion and went over and said, "What the heck is going on over here?" And these guys are moaning and groaning and not having a good day from Abraham down. Now, he must have had some pretty loyal household members, mustn't he? That all the men in that household lined up for this fine opportunity. But they did. So from him, 99, on down, they all had to be circumcised. And so they were. And by the way, later on in the New Testament era, Gentiles, Gentile dogs, are called foreskins. I don't find that real complimentary myself. But when the Jews wanted to insult the Gentiles, they called them foreskins because they generally were not circumcised. But the Jews had to be. So that had to take place. That would be the sign between Abraham and God and all his descendants. If they believed this covenant, they would have their male children circumcised. So God said to Abraham in verse 15, "As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai anymore, but shall call her Sarah." Not a big change there. A change from my princess to simply princess. I don't know what that's all about. There's probably something to that that I don't get, but her name was changed a little bit also, perhaps to just mark the occasion, maybe. Abraham kind of gets a new start, a new name, and so on. Maybe it was to do the same thing basically for her, I'm not sure. But her name gets changed there as well. So she goes from Sarai to Sarah. "I will bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her." Yikes. He's 99, she's 89. How many 89-year-old women can have a son? Not that many. "I'll bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall come from her." Now, this is probably one of the most ridiculous things that they've heard in a long time. And Abraham falls on his face and laughs and said in his heart, he's not saying this out loud, but said in his heart, "Will a child be born to a man 100 years old and Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?" Well, his part of the deal is not as difficult as hers, but it seemed difficult to them in either way. Either one of them would actually produce a child here at their advanced ages. Clearly, she is past the normal childbearing years. Her reproductive system has shut down, as is typical of everybody, every woman, as time goes on. And they're looking at what God has said, or they're thinking about what God has said, and say, "Wait a minute, we ain't got the wherewithal here anymore." And so Abraham says to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might believe before thee." He's offering up sort of an alternative possibility that he thinks is a little more realistic. He says, "Well, let Ishmael be that guy. Let Ishmael be the one through whom my descendants come and fulfills the Abrahamic covenant and all that stuff." And God said, "No." Verse 19, "That ain't happening, Abraham. Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac," which means laughter. He's named for the response that his parents had to this God statement. "And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him." That's why on that chart I showed you the Abrahamic covenant provisions flows through Isaac, not Ishmael. So what God is saying here is that, no, I'm going to provide a son through you two, you and your wife Sarah. And it will be through him that my blessings will flow to you. "But as for Ishmael, I've heard you. Behold, I will bless him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall become the father of 12 princes. I will make him a great nation." We looked at the chart there, shows us 12 sons. So God did indeed bless him. He is Abraham's son. And so he blesses him because of that. "But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you at this season next year." So God says, forget that alternative plan, Abraham. You're going to have a son through your wife, Sarah. Your 99-year-old wife is going to have a son about this time next year, in the normal 9-month time frame it takes for gestation of a human child. And when he finished talking with him, God went up from Abraham, and Abraham took Ishmael, his son, and all the servants who were born in his house, and all who were bought with money, every male among the men of Abraham's household, and circumcised the flesh of their foreskin in the very same day as God had said to him. So he goes ahead and does that, and I'm just impressed at the response of his household males to something like this at this age. The children, of course, do what they're told, or maybe were forced to, but the men agreed to do this. They know they're going to be laid up for a few days. Remember that deal at Shechem? We'll see that later. When Joseph's sons came in and killed a bunch of Shechemites for raping their sister, it's because they were all incapacitated because they'd just been circumcised. So they're laying around for 2 or 3 days now, very vulnerable, very unsafe. But nevertheless, they all go ahead and do this. Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. After the Lord appeared to him all these different times, they've ratified the covenant in chapter 15, and now they've instituted the sign of belief in the covenant here in chapter 17. So Ishmael, his son, was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, and the very same day Abraham was circumcised, and Ishmael, his son, and all the men of his household who were born in the house or bought with money from a foreigner were circumcised with him. So the main takeaway in chapter 17, there's several of them, birth of Ishmael being one of them, but the institution of circumcision as the sign of belief in the Abrahamic covenant is established in Genesis chapter 17. And that sign is in place down to this day. Jewish parents to this day that are believers in that covenant and believe God, the spiritual line within the physical line, the believers, believing Jews, have their male children circumcised on the 8th day of life, as God told them to do. For reasons we know, but that they didn't. That's the vitamin K, the blood coagulation issue with life on the 8th day. All right, any question about chapter 17 and what it's all about? The 5th appearance to God in our sequence here of appearances, when Abraham was roughly 100 years old, and at that point, God institutes the procedure of circumcision as a sign of belief in the Abrahamic covenant. Okay, got that down? That's always the sign of belief in that covenant. All right. Chapter 18.
I have a question.
Yeah, Pete, go ahead.
Okay. Did I hear you right that Sarah didn't have a sign because she didn't need a sign because Abraham did and they became one? Right?
Correct.
Okay. You said physically and emotionally. Is that what you said?
Yes.
And you said that real fast and I'm like...
Yeah, the marriage, the becoming of one flesh is more than just a physical union. It's a union of beings emotionally and physically. In other words, you can have physical contact between a man and a woman and not have a marriage. Anybody doubt that? That goes on all the time. See? But a marriage is both a physical union and an emotional union between the two. So that's why I said that. Just a physical union does not make a marriage.
So you just say that because you know that that's scriptural?
Well, sexual promiscuity doesn't produce a oneness of spirit and life. Otherwise, practically everybody on the planet is married to a whole bunch of other different people because of the physical unions that have taken place.
Well, don't you think a lot of people don't know that? Don't live this? I mean, when you see the world?
Well, there's a lot of people who don't pay any attention to anything the Bible says. The principles in Scripture don't mean nothing to most people. But they should mean something to God's children, us believers.
I don't feel like I hear it that much.
I beg your pardon?
I was married for 57 years. In my teachings, I haven't heard that much. I haven't heard that much about emotional oneness.
Yeah, you could probably throw in the word psychological as well, too. It just gets harder to define. But, Peggy.
You know, I think that's why when so many people live together and they don't get married and then they break up, it's not just La La Land. They are hurt. That's the emotion. You know, when you have that intimacy with someone, it is an emotional connection.
No, I believe that.
You know, that's the emotional part. Why the Lord doesn't want you to do it, because He knows how you are going to be hurt. It just doesn't work. That's what I see.
Yeah, my mind bender wasn't supposed to cause you any great angst. I was just trying to show you that when two are one flesh, you don't need two marks. One flesh suffices. Yeah, Betty.
Well, it got my brain going when I realized that Ishmael was circumcised also.
Yeah, he was in Abraham's household at that time, and all people in that household. He might have had some other servants from Egypt. He might have had some other people and so on around too, some Arabs.
So, but he took another road. I guess Jewish people can also.
Beg your pardon?
He took another path in life.
Yeah. He was described as someone that was going to be separate from his other brothers and kind of be a problem living over here, kind of a wild donkey of a guy. Mm-hmm. So he was... He's kind of depicted as an outsider right from the beginning. He was described that way before he was ever born. And there seems to be a consistency of history that would go along with that as well. Yeah, Susan.
A couple of comments. Sarah always gets the rap for laughing. And I would like to point out that in verse 17, David fell on his face.
Yeah. I was trying to get on past this passage and move on, but I wasn't quick enough.
Verse 18, would you say that when Abraham said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee," that is the first recorded prayer in the Bible, and it's a daddy praying for his sons?
I hadn't thought about that before, but that may very well be true. Abraham is trying again, as he and Sarah both did, to help God out solve this problem. So he's suggesting, well, here's a solution, God, since you don't seem to be able to get this done, just use Ishmael as my descendant. And God said, that ain't what I'm going to do. So yeah, he's being a father and trying to help God out at the same time. And we do that a lot, don't we? When things ain't coming together the way we want them to, we try to help God out with our good man-made plans, and they usually end up blowing up in our faces. And that's kind of what was going on there. But, you can appreciate, I think, their difficulty in grasping what God is saying. I mean, a 99-year-old guy, I say a 100-year-old guy, and an 80-year-old, a 90-year-old lady, how many times are they going to have a child? Apart from divine help, they ain't ever going to have a child. Her reproductive system is not functioning anymore. It's gone the way of all women. She's gotten beyond that. So she can't have a child anymore. She's not ovulating. She doesn't have the hormones that are necessary to make all that stuff work. So how in the world can that possibly happen? How can that promise be? And clearly their stress here, their strain, their difficulty is having to accept and believe a statement from God that is, in their minds at least, way out there in left field. But we'll see how that will come about. Yeah, Jerry?
God uses infertility several times, though, through Rebecca and Rachel, Hannah. So that's not an unusual situation there.
Yeah.
It's unusual. Well, but that's one way, because that gets people's attention.
Yeah. Well, what makes this one kind of different is their age. Yeah, infertility is used a variety of places, as you see. But in this case, it's infertility due to just being postmenopausal, way postmenopausal. I mean, even if she lived to be 125, she'd probably stop being able to bear children at about 60-ish, maybe.
And she may not have ever had many eggs.
And she hadn't had any yet, so there's some kind of a problem already. Something is wrong with her system already. So yes, the additional difficulty in this case is the age of the participants, along with God controlling the product of the womb. But God's going to control the circumstance here, as we know. I tell you what, maybe instead of jumping on into chapter 18, which we ain't going to get very far because of the time, let's think about this for a second. God promised Sarah that she's going to have a son. If I remember right, is there a ghost up there in it then? If I remember right, the male has two types of what am I trying to say? A word I can't pull up. 1 through 23, what are those?
Chromosomes.
Thank you. Oh, gosh. The male has two kinds of chromosomes for chromosome number 23. The female doesn't. She has one kind. It's called Y. But the male has half of his are X's and half of his chromosome number 23's are Y's. X's and Y's. So the odds of the child being born at conception is 50-50, being a female or a male. It just depends on which one of them little swimmers gets there first. There's 250,000 of them trying to get there. How do you guarantee that the one that gets there first is the X chromosome? To make an Isaac instead of an Alice. Who guarantees that process? How does God know that Sarah is going, this is a one-shot deal for Sarah. She's not going to go through this three or four times. How does he know that she's going to have a male child? That chromosome number 23 from Abraham that gets there first is an X. How does he know that?
God's in control of all things.
Because he controls that, doesn't he? Now, some people will recognize that God controls what's in the womb following conception. But what I'm saying to you is that God controls what goes on in that womb before conception. He controls the process of conception. All 23 of them chromosomes have to go find their counterpart and line up right. One has to find one, two has to find two, three has to find three from male to female. All those have to line up and join together to get a normal birth. If they don't, you get serious birth diseases, Down syndromes and things like that. So if you get a normal birth of a male child, God has controlled the matching of all 23 sets of chromosomes and he's brought an X in there first. And there's no way he can say with certainty that's going to happen unless he controls it, because 50-50 is the chance of it being a female. There's just as many female chromosomes running in there as there are male. And when that first one gets there, he shuts the door on all the other ones. When that egg is fertilized, it puts out a barrier, a shield. Number two can't get there. Number two through number 250,000 are just wasted. They can't do nothing. So that first fertilizing cell from Abraham had to be chromosome number 23, had to be an X for her to have an Isaac. And that's what happened, because God controlled all of that. And here we are in our great wisdom, thinking that we can go into that womb at 3 months later, 6 months later, maybe even 9 months later, and destroy what God has established there. It's going to be a bad day at the White Throne Judgment for a lot of doctors. A lot of doctors that have destroyed helpless infants are going to get to look God in the eye and explain why they did that. And they are going to be toast. There will be no explanation that is suitable. There will be no justification for the slaughter of infants, helpless infants, by mankind of a creation that God has put together. So that day is coming. It's a day of reckoning coming for those people. And we'll be there to see that. Won't necessarily be fun to watch, but it will be just when God punishes the wicked for the destruction of his children as infants. So Isaac is going to be brought into life by the sovereign superintendence of God and make sure he is a male, and that will all take place and happen. We got to get another little thing done before we get to that. Sodom and Gomorrah is another significant event that we want to look at. We'll look at it next time when we get back together. Any questions about anything we've seen here this morning? The birth of Ishmael and the institution of circumcision as the sign of belief in this covenant, and the fact that it is going to flow through Isaac and only Isaac, not through Ishmael and Isaac. And so the history of the Jewish people in fulfillment of that covenant is that they come from Isaac, not Ishmael. Question about any of that stuff? Yeah, Jane?
Muslims come from Abraham, and Jewish people come from Abraham, both.
Yes. Now, he's the father of both, Isaac and Ishmael. But the Arabs claim Isaac as their ancestor for the most part. And he's a wild donkey of a man.
No, Ishmael.
Ishmael, beg your pardon. And of course, the Jewish people, Isaac. And we'll see that develop as we go along here a little. Yeah, Bill?
What do you think the Mosaic covenant sign was?
Keeping the Sabbath. If you believe in the Mosaic covenant as a Jew, you would keep the Sabbath. You wouldn't do any work on the Sabbath. Of course, the Pharisees perverted that to the point where you couldn't even spit on the Sabbath. But that was a ridiculous Pharisaic perversion. The basic law was you just didn't do any work on the Sabbath. You sat down, took a rest, and rejuvenated on the Sabbath, which is a Saturday, not Sunday. Yeah, B.
Well, of course, the Jewish people, they still circumcised. Do you suppose that the Arabs do this also, since they were originally?
I don't know, because they're not under any covenant obligation to do so. So I don't know what their cultural practice is.
But not all the Muslims are Arabs either, are they?
No, that's true. And by the way, I don't know if you know this or not, but their birth rate is, Muslims can have 3 or 4 kids per family, and they can have like 3 or 4 wives. So a Muslim can father 10 to 12 children at the time that the Western societies are fathering 1 or 2. Who's going to have the numbers in about 30 years? They can take over countries with their reproductive systems and never fire a shot because of their birth rate versus the Western society's birth rate. And that's going on everywhere. Places in Europe and even to sit here, the cities are being taken over by Muslims because the birth rate is just so high amongst them and so low among Westerners. Yeah, Bill?
The Gentiles don't wait 8 days to circumcise their babies.
I don't know what the medical system today recommends or suggests or whatever. That would be the best day if you have the option.
Hospital.
1 or 2 days?
24 hours
or so? Well, they may have enough aids today that the coagulation issue is not as important as maybe it was back then. I don't know.
Oh,
8 days? Yeah, I guess it depends maybe on your doctors and your medical help as to what they recommend, all that stuff. But Okay, no class next week, of course. That's Thanksgiving. Class the following week. We'll be back in our regular study. And then the week after that, which is the 7th of December, will be our luncheon and everything. Everybody got the plan down? Okay. Don't come here next week. All right. We'll let you all go, and we'll see you next 2 weeks, Lord willing.